This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Nina Riggs was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2015, but she wasn't too surprised. The disease runs in her family, and Nina had watched her own mother battle cancer for years. But when Nina was 38 years old, her cancer began to spread, and it eventually became incurable. She wanted to be mindful of her time left, but was determined to not let the diagnosis control her life. Nina was a writer, but also a wife and a mother, and after her diagnosis, she started to chronicle family stories and reflections as she endured treatment. Her essays grew in popularity, and last fall, she had a piece published in the New York Times Modern Love column. That essay sparked a full-length memoir. Nina died earlier this year, but before she passed away, she finished her first book. It's called The Bright Hour, A Memoir of Living and Dying. Joining me now is John Duperstein. He's Nina's husband. He'll be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on Tuesday, June 20th to talk more about the book, but first he joins me in studio. John, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me, Anita.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. So tell us more about how this memoir happened for Nina. I know there was a New York Times Modern Love column, but there was a lot of other things in motion at this time as well.
Well, the New York Times piece really was the sort of the catalyst for the bigger project. Nina had always been a writer, and she had a pretty big catalog of writing that she'd either published or had been working on, but almost exclusively had been a poet for her creative outlet as a writer. And so, yeah, this was really the first time that she had used the essay form or written nonfiction for any substantial outlet in her career. The New York Times piece really, I think, it gave her a wider readership, obviously, and that was fantastic. But I think it also reinforced that she was onto a real project here and not just a series of essays.
Okay, so you were talking about her gaining this huge readership. What was that experience like, and how did that change how Nina thought of herself as a writer, or did it?
I think it did. I mean, I always had a lot of confidence in her as a writer, and I think she did too. I mean, I think it shows in her work, but I don't think she thought of herself as having that big an audience, partly because as a poet, you really don't. You can be a really, really, really good poet, and your audience can be basically the Academy of Poets, unfortunately. And I think that was part of her frustration with poetry, was that she felt, for example, when she used to read her poems to her family, to her mom and dad, who aren't, you know, who are both really smart people, but neither one of them reads contemporary poetry. And so it was sort of like, I don't even have that audience, and those are my people. So I think it really boosted her in terms of realizing that she could reach a much wider audience and still write the exact kind of thing that she wanted to write.
So one of the things she writes about in the New York Times column that then sort of continues to play out during the book is this theme of how you live a meaningful life with limited time. And she has this beautiful story in the prologue about teaching her son to ride his bike without training wheels. Can you tell us a bit about that story and how it sort of sets up what the whole book is about?
Yeah, it's kind of, the story's kind of become a legendary thing in our household. In fact, where she tripped in the sidewalk is like right out in front of our house. And every time we walk past it, the boys sort of give it a wide berth. they're not like upset or anything. They're just like, oh, that's where mom tripped. But sort of nursing Benny towards being able to ride his bike without training wheels.
Benny's your younger son.
He's the younger of our two kids, and he's by far the more cautious. And here in that very moment, that was the first indication we really had that her cancer was going to be metastatic. We didn't know at that point, of course, but we knew something was really wrong. I mean, she was in an enormous amount of pain. But in that moment was this, you know, really wonderful, successful moment of parenting. And Benny, of course, was thrilled. And I think that's if you could reduce the book to a single theme, I think it's exactly what you said. It is, those things don't stop being meaningful. They don't stop being wonderful, even just because you're more acutely aware than most people are of how limited your time is.
So she's processing a lot of the things that are happening to her and your family in real time, which means that you all become characters. You're living the lives and you're also characters in the book. What was that experience like? And maybe you can set up one of the readings I think you're going to do for us where you very much had to witness yourself as a character.
Yeah. No, it's totally true. Her, she wrote the New York Times piece late summer, and then in September of 2016, it came out in the New York Times. I think it was mid-September or late September. And then between then and January, when she handed in the final manuscript, she wrote the book. So obviously a lot of the events that are depicted in the book happened in that time period. Seeing yourself portrayed for the first time can be weird, but and it was. And the scene that I'm going to read, I would say, is probably the most, initially, was the most difficult for me to read. And I said to her, I think, yeah, this one really threw me for a loop. And she said, oh, really? You know, do you want me to change anything? And I thought about it for a few minutes and I said, no, you nailed it. Like, you got it absolutely right. That's why it was hard for me to read, I think, initially. And now it's one of my favorite passages in the whole book, because I think it captures so much of what we struggled with as a couple. And it's called Dispatch from the Dark. Speaking of the dark, it's past midnight and we're lying in bed. I just can't wait for things to get back to normal, says John from his side of the moon. I'm not sure how to respond. I hadn't realized how attached I have become to the idea that, even in all of this, we are moving ahead somehow, and that dealing with all this is something to value. I feel a sharpness in my throat, the slip of the sureness beneath me. I can't handle you saying that, I say after a silence, even though I know he isn't trying to fight. Thinking that way kind of invalidates my whole life right now. I have to love these days in the same way that I love any other. There might not be a normal from here on out. He's not happy. I feel the cool bricks of an invisible wall settling into place between us. I turn away to face the window, a heavy orange haze filtering in through the trees. It's not as dark out as it should be. I don't believe you, he says. I don't think you're being honest. It's the tone I've heard him use when I've told him he's being a crappy parent, or that no matter what, I'm probably never going to like watching hockey. Anger that morphs from hurt. I really think that you're in some kind of whacked out denial right now if you think these days are lovable. These days are days, I say, calm and furious. We choose how we hold them. Good night. Around 4 a.m., I feel his hand on my back. I'm so afraid I can't breathe, he whispers. I know, I say, scooching a little toward him, but still facing away. So am I. Montaigne. I learn to mistrust my steps everywhere, and I take care to control them. He also believes in lively shouting matches before meals and only begetting children before sleep. We are doing it all wrong.
That's John Duberstein reading from The Bright Hour, a memoir of living and dying, written by his wife, Nina Riggs. John will be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro Tuesday, June 20th to talk about the memoir. So I love that because it's so meta. I can imagine sort of you reading her writing about that and her writing it knowing you're going to read it. How much did you all process the memoir in real time as she was writing?
A ton. We talked about it all the time, and I was her most avid reader. I always really liked reading her work, even though I'm probably less useful in some ways as a reader of poetry, but I got pretty good at reading her work. I knew her process. She was a real intense reviser of her own work. She was a real believer in the phrase, I think, is kill your darlings is the writing phrase, the workshop phrase. And I got to understand that and understand why. And I would see her toss out lines that she loved and make the poem better and things like that. So I learned a lot from her as an aide-de-camp more than anything. But, you know, overall, I think she didn't have to be super sensitive about the narrative because, like the thing with me, like portraying our fight in that scene that I just read, you know, she was being so true and so honest to what was happening and so sensitive about other people's involvement that I don't see a whole lot of people reading this and coming away with anything but a really, you know, a really good vibe from what she wrote about them.
In that passage, she makes a reference to Montaigne. And in reading her book, I mean, it's clear that she is a poet. There's so much poetry to how she writes. But she's also a descendant of Ralph Waldo Emerson. So she has this legacy of incredible writers and poets sort of in her back pocket. Tell us about her connection to her heritage and her relationship with that.
Yeah, it's wild. And, you know, the first time she told me, I think I sort of asked her to repeat herself and re-explain. You know, Nina talks about it in the book. It's a big legacy to carry, especially if you are like Nina. I think Nina was writing poetry when she was like just barely old enough to write. So like she picked that, or it picked her, or however it happened, very early in life. So to be a creative person coming up in the world with you know, the great-great-granddaughter of Ralph Waldo Emerson as your one of your descriptors, I think was more burden than comfort for a long time. But she totally warmed to it when she was older, and you know, really not just rediscovered Emerson's work, but I think really felt a deep resonance with it. And, you know, she's actually, I think, in a way, kind of doing this really neat thing where she's all at once talking about her ancestor and her ancestry and all of those things, the Puritanism and the transcendentalism and all those things. But she's also relating it directly to the experience that she's going through, this finality. And she talks a lot about Emerson in his later years, not the vigorous sage of Concord, but this guy who's like battling dementia. He's dealing with having sickness. He's, you know, writing in beautiful imagery about his own eventual death. And she renders all of that so close and so personal to her own experience that it makes it, from my perspective at least, really close to the reader's experience too. And I think that's an enormous accomplishment. She makes it seem easy when you read it, but I really think it's one of the amazing subtleties in the text.
So you mentioned finality there, and I want you to talk a bit about a scene that you describe in the book where you're driving home and you're talking with your sons about being healthy and being sick, and sort of how do we understand what finality means, especially when you're talking to kids. Can you tell me a bit about that part of the book?
Yeah, it's funny. We were at Duke Hospital, and we were attending this thing called Kids Can. It's a program for kids whose parents have been diagnosed with cancer and are being treated for cancer. And, you know, the presumption there among all of the parents is we're all sort of actively wanting to be communicating with our kids and be keeping them up to speed on what's happening. And we were pretty frank with our kids. We talked about it in ways that we thought were not unduly, you know, harsh or adult, but that were pretty open. And we talked to them about how serious cancer is. And of course, they'd gone through losing their grandmother, and they knew that cancer could be a fatal condition. But somehow we had, you know, failed at some point to check in. And basically what had happened was Nina had gone from, this is the classic sort of chemo thing, is people see chemo patients who have lost their hair or have other side effects, and they assume you are really sick. Whereas people walking around who have all their hair and a cancer diagnosis and don't look sick might actually be the people who are sickest, because that means they're not in active treatment. And so Nina was in that phase too, and it was the first time that we'd experienced that. And we didn't realize the extent to which, especially our younger son, Benny, but Freddie too, the older of our two sons, had made that inference. They had drawn the inference that, well, mom looks great. And so the conversation basically started when one of them said, they were reporting to us what they had told, they had shared aloud at KidsCan, and said, yeah, we told them that you were really sick and that all of that had been really hard, but then you were feeling a whole lot better. And of course, the opposite was true prognostically. She had gone from being, you know, just having a small tumor in her breast to having metastatic triple negative breast cancer, which is a much worse diagnosis. And so, yeah, Nina wound up riding the whole way home with them in the back seat. And there was a lot of tears and a lot of being jostled out of a place that we hadn't realized how comfortable they were in with her health. And so it really was an important lesson for us in communicating with the kids. We were very communication forward. We're very open with our kids, but we still managed to miss the signs that they hadn't kept up with what was going on with her, at least not in the final details. Like you were saying, the ultimate thing, is this going to be something that that she recovers from? And she had to tell them in that conversation, it's not. I'm never going to get better. This is something that when I die, I don't know when that's going to be, but this is going to almost certainly be the thing that kills me. So yeah, it was hard.
So Nina passed earlier this year. When did it first hit you that you were now a single father?
Well, we talked about it a lot before she died, right up through the time when she was in hospice. It was, you know, I think a cancer diagnosis for anyone raises the first thing that comes to most people's mind, even mine now, and I've been through it, obviously, is fear. And in some ways, that fear is fear of death and mortality and all that stuff. But I think honestly, the things that we were both most afraid of were fear of how this is going to change in terms of parenting, was a big one. Fear of loneliness, fear of loss and all of that stuff was part of it. But, you know, when you're raising small kids, much of your world revolves around the decisions that you're making as a couple vis-a-vis the kids. You know, what schools are they going to go to? What activities are they going to do? Those have always been for us really shared endeavors. We put our heads together a lot. We did a lot of huddling and a lot of conversation around raising children. But I was, if anything, really more of a follower than a leader. Like, Nina had a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm for family. And she was much more generative than I was. I was always enthusiastic because of her enthusiasm. I sort of had a contact high. But she really generated a lot of it and a lot of the energy and a lot of the ideas in our family life. So my fear was that we were going to lose that. It wasn't just a matter of losing a person that we all loved more than anything, which is bad enough in some ways to think about. But, you know, the practical parts, you know, who am I going to collude with? Who's going to be my advisor? And, you know, how am I going to do all this by myself? But I think it happened gradually. You know, I think even after she died and even after the memorial service, which was a couple of weeks later, I was still emerging into that. And it really was only by dint of practice that I, and still am, really trying to figure out what it means to be a solo parent.
So you have two boys. Can you tell me about any moments in the past few months that really stand out to you that sort of have given you hope for how you all will continue together as a family? Because I know they've been a huge support for you and your grieving process.
Yeah, totally. They're wonderful. You know, they're boys. They're a pain in the neck. They're kids. Kids are a challenge. And there's no shortage of frustration. It's hard being with them by myself as much as I am. But we just, this past weekend for Memorial Day, went up to Nashawn, which is the place where Nina's family has gone for generations up in Massachusetts. And I was putting them to bed one night and I said, you know, how's it going, guys? How are you feeling? And they said, we're having so much fun. We're so happy. And Benny said, yeah, it's kind of weird without mom, but we really are very happy here. And, you know, they listed all the things that they had done. They had gone fishing with their Uncle Steve. We'd done all this stuff with Grand Pete, and we played with the chickens. We got new chickens this year and all this stuff. And it was all the stuff that you look forward to when you go on that kind of vacation. And so I felt like, you know, I was really glad Benny said what he said in a way, because if they weren't perceiving her presence or her absence there, it would kind of worry me. I would be like, well, are they not dealing? Are they not processing? But at the same time, the whole reason we went was for them to have fun. So if they weren't enjoying it, or if they weren't also aware of the loss part of it, either way, I think it would have been too bad. And, you know, it's like the kids say the darndest things stuff. You know, every once in a while, they just say it. They don't have to read tea leaves. They just actually come out and say it. And it's sort of like this weekend is dedicated to their mom. So that too.
So we're going to have to wrap up in a second. But I mean, you all have had a whirlwind of the past few years with her diagnosis and everything happening really fast. You went on a wonderful trip abroad together. Now you're doing events around the book that she wrote about her life, living and dying. What do you think she would say if she could sort of see you here talking about her book and her first sort of collection of published work?
Gosh, I don't know. I think she would be thrilled. You know, obviously she'd rather be here doing it herself, and I would rather that she be doing that too. But we talked about it a lot. What she told me literally was, I want you to do everything that you feel good doing and be as engaged in it as you want to be. And for me, ever since the moment she was gone, the happiest and most complete that I've been in terms of this stuff is actively working on the project. And it, you know, it's one of the common myths of bereavement that you're not supposed to bring up the person who died. And it's exactly the opposite. Obviously, most people who have been through it know that. But every chance I get to talk about her and to talk about the book is just, it's a thrill for me. And it's cathartic. It's therapeutic. So I think she'd be really happy with that. I think she'd be really pleased.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
My guest is John Duberstein. He joined us to talk about the new book, The Bright Hour, a memoir of living and dying, written by his wife, Nina Riggs. John will be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on Tuesday, June 20th to talk about the memoir. And you can find more details about that on our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Songs That Tell a Story, the unique chamber soul sound of Shauna Tucker. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Shine, shine, shine.